Welcome to the best of the RSN Breakfast Club. Here's a little bit of what we did. Take a listen.
Nice to welcome back Adam White to the Breakfast Club on a Tuesday morning. Good morning, Whitey.
Good morning, Daniel. It was extraordinary watching yesterday with that golf that we were sort of trying to do a show and watch at the same time. But what Brooks Koepka has been able to achieve over the last, particularly 18 months to 2 years, has been quite extraordinary. And we'll talk to Greg about what he's doing to golf, because we talk about what Tiger Woods did to golf and maybe even what Greg Norman did to golf.
Yep.
But Brooks Koepka's doing something to golf that I'm not sure whether it's a good or a bad thing, to be perfectly honest. It is a good talking point, but it's very, very interesting.
It's a thing. It's certainly a thing. We'll see what Greg thinks about that a little bit later on. Jimmy Vartel is back. Brownlow medalist Norm Smith, medalist triple premiership player. Good tan living. Morning, Jim.
Morning, Daniel. How are you?
Going beautifully.
What are you? Now, look, I know the three of us aren't... Well, we don't enjoy the conversations around MRO and all that sort of stuff, but I'd wanted to ask you two learned gentlemen about Michael Christian's comments.
What's he done?
About if he was to crack down like everyone would like him to on punching, that there'd be carnage. So he's almost putting it in the... I don't want to paraphrase him in the wrong way here, but the too hard basket.
Too hard basket.
Mm. So would it be carnage, or would it be, yes, 1 or 2 weeks of you've got a lot of work to do, but the penny would drop pretty quickly?
I would think that the playing...
This is not a go at Michael Christian. It is, a talking point if you were to crack down on it.
Yep. I would think that if there was to be a standard to be set... Now, I'm not sure now's the right time to be doing it, to be fair. There needs to be a...
But the principle...
Adjustment over the new season. I would think that once there was a standard set and penalties handed out, sanctions handed out for a week or two, that the playing cohort would very quickly understand what was and what wasn't acceptable.
Because they do adapt very quickly to the rules, don't they?
Well, you know that better than anyone, Jim. You did it for a long time.
Yeah. So, what do you think, Waddy?
I don't want any change made during the season.
No, I'm not saying a change during the season, but like if the video goes around pre-season, Michael Christian does his tour, which they all do, like the umpires do it, and they give you a heads up what's happening during the year. That's why, protected zone, they would have gone around and told all the players about that. But if they just said, look, this is not overly complicated, a strike... any striking, that's elbows, punches, swinging arms, whatever it be, you're looking at a week.
Yeah, look, I don't have any issue with it. I think it has to actually go more to the umpires in paying free kicks at the time. And if you start paying free kicks and start paying 50-metre penalties, then I think you'll crack down on that before it even goes to the match review panel. And there was a couple of incidents on the weekend where, in my view, umpires were clearly harsher on players for silly acts than they had been previous weeks. There was a 50-metre penalty paid. At one point, I remember the umpire saying, I just don't know why you do it, mate.
I did and
I thought, that's good umpiring, because you don't have to do it. And it was just a sort of a forearm to the back of an opponent when he was unexpected.
Was that Essendon Security Friday night? It was one of those that paid early.
Yeah.
And then there was a 50 on top of that.
Yep. And, Brent Harvey spoke about this on our show on Friday, saying that, as the sort of player he was where he got a lot of attention from the opposition. He was sick and tired of the punches into the ribs or the knocking in the back when he wasn't expecting it. And I think that you start paying free kicks. That's what the third umpire was brought into the AFL for, to look for those things behind the play. And if you start paying the free kicks and 50-metre penalties that penalise your team at the time, then players will get the message very quickly, well, I can't really be doing that because it's going to cost my team. And it won't even get to the tribunal situation.
Yeah. There was one in the Melbourne-Sydney game. I remember it came back after a goal and the umpire just blew the whistle and just said the exact same thing. He was mic'd up and just goes, why are you doing it?
Yeah.
I have to pay that.
And the response from the player was interesting because they just went, yeah, probably a good point. And that's the thing is that I'd like to see the umpires be, because you certainly see it half in rugby union.
Yep.
Where the umpires have a little bit more authority in the way that they do their business out on the field. Take control of the game.
They have more respect. That's what they have.
Well, there's no doubt about that. Now, you'll get the people to say, it's all about the umpires, the Ray Chamberlain, Darren Goldspink style. But there's ways of doing it where you can actually have real authority in the way the game is played by the way you go about your umpiring. And I think too much of the time that... It's not about the 50 metres for back chat either. It's actually about being strong in the way you go about it as an umpire. And I reckon you'll eradicate a lot of the problems that we have out on the field.
Yep. So are we talking for out-of-zone umpires, non-controlling as we call them these days, that their responsibility needs to be a bit more sharper focused?
Yep. Well, they've got the responsibility, don't they? They just...
Well, they've got the chance to. The power is there, Jim.
Yep.
I prefer to see umpires... the non-controlling umpires being more worried about what is happening around a contest as opposed to wanting to pay a free kick for I saw that from 100 metres away that you didn't see from 20 metres away on a different angle.
So, yeah, stuff that shouldn't be happening as opposed to things that they might be able to see.
Yeah, you don't need... You don't need...
Not sure about, but...
Clean it up.
Yeah, you don't need two sets of eyes on where the ball is if you can have two sets of eyes on the whole contest.
Yep.
It's a little bit like...
Yep. That makes sense.
Yep.
I'm drawing a pretty weird comparison here.
I like it.
It's a little bit like in a AFL game, if you're on listening to it on radio or on television, is that the commentators will be watching the game and seeing the game unfold. The guy on the boundary is the one that's meant to be looking at things that the guys upstairs can't see. So they're looking at things that are happening on the bench. They're looking at things that are happening behind the play, things that you can't see upstairs. And I think that's the same situation with the non-controlling umpire, that they should be looking for things that are happening behind the play, things that the umpire that is in control can't see because he's concentrating on the game. You'll be very surprised at how much you can pick up if you're actually just sort of keeping your eyes on what's happening, you know, the eyes and ears for the umpire that is in control of the game, that is concentrating on what is happening where the action is.
Right, yeah.
It's a bit of a weird comparison, but you know what I mean?
Yeah. Makes sense.
Don't watch the game. Actually watch the periphery.
I'm okay with that, Jim.
I'm very happy with it.
Righto. Look very comfortable. Very relaxed there this morning. It's good.
Yep.
Nice that you're feeling comfortable today.
Yeah, lounge lizard.
On the Breakfast Club.
What did you think of the Carl Hooker one?
What did Carl do again? Just remind
just
me.
Like a sort of a swinging sort of...
Swinging arm into a contest. Yeah. He was a bit frustrated at the time.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts on that?
It's almost the way to... Sounds funny. Whack someone without using the knuckles.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's been done for forever.
Yep.
I think that's something we should be trying to get out.
Hmm.
I think that's, as I'm saying to Jim, that's been happening for bloody ever.
Oh, no
doubt. It's a free hit because you're not really punching, but you sort of are, and you're just getting enough impact to...
I was trying to punch the ball.
Yeah, make yourself feel good about punching someone without doing it. That's sort of what it is. It's a nothing action, and it's not necessary. They're the type of things I think that we need to try and start to just take out.
It's just like weeding the garden. Just clean up all the rubbish, get it out, and let the whatever. That's a really bad thing to comparison, but anyway.
You're on the comparison
I'm gonna
train.
Let you keep going,
but with the Kyle Hooker one,
I love your comparisons.
With the Kyle Hooker one, I think it was a very dangerous thing to do. I think he actually hit mainly the ball and he didn't really hit anyone in the head. I actually am comfortable with the fine, but I don't think it's any more than that. But I do think it's a very silly / dangerous thing to be doing.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure dangerous, but it's a silly thing to do.
The potential for dangerous, what I mean.
It's unnecessary is what it is. Mm. And they're the sort of things that we can clean up without affecting the contest.
Mm.
And I think we should be trying to do that. Speaking of cleaning up, did you see the behind... the different camera angle to the Warpole-Selwood contest from Saturday at the MCG.
Mm.
If Joel Selwood had connected, if Warpole, the rising star for round 21, hadn't have spun out of the contest with great instinct, Joel Selwood's not playing for the next couple. He came in shoulder ready to club.
Yeah.
That was dangerous for Joel. He needs to just be careful finals time just to pull back that one.
You've got to get that first, Daniel.
Well, no, but had there not been a terrific spin by the Round 21 Rising Star that I mentioned, the Warpedo, your man, Warpedo.
Hey, he's my man.
Yeah, but Whitey just inserts him.
I own him first.
He inserts him, just Warpedo, into any conversation that Whitey at the moment. He's unbelievable.
He's like Ronaldo and Elvis and Madonna.
Sure. That's who he is. I hadn't seen that footage until last night. I'm like, bloody hell, he is lucky Warpedo got out of it.
You have a look at it, he makes the decision that, oh, hang on, he's there before me. and he goes to flick the foot, or can I kick it away from him? And then he just tucks in, and I'm just going to cannon through.
Just going to bash him. It's lucky. But your man, the Warpedo, got through. He's getting some love across the competition, James.
So he should, because he's a footballer, and I like it. Footballers first. If you've noticed something over the last couple of years that we've come to know each other, Daniel.
Yes.
My preference for players, or in my top 10 list, are footballers first. And that is what the Warpedo is.
So why then, you're in the list management game, let's flesh this out a bit. Why then do we continue to find these gems at 40 and 50 and 60 rather than 15 and 30?
Because certain players like that, he was actually dominant at underage level.
So what's the problem, Jim?
And it's just my opinion, is players like James Walpole end up being put in the category of they start looking at things that they can't do and they focus on what he can't do. So players at the top of the draft, and, you know, catch your eye, and we write articles on it, we get fascinated. Oh, look at that, you know, breakaway speed and the running bounces and things like that. And they might do it once every 3 weeks. But we don't focus on the guys who, James Walpole, another 25 touches and 7 or 8 tackles. Oh, but he doesn't have this, but he doesn't have that. And we start to pick apart players, and sometimes players who have been dominant underage football for a while, because he was all Australian, he was Vic Country, he was Geelong Falcons, premiership captain. We start to go, oh, okay, that's what he does, but now let's just keep pulling him apart. And that's when they start to slide down the draft order.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I think the other one too is, which I have heard a bit over the time, is, oh, there's not a lot of scope for improvement.
He's hit his ceiling.
What you see is what you get. I don't think he can. There's not much sort of wriggle room. He is what he is, and it's sort of like, yeah. But that's case of Warpole, he's captain of Vic Country, or captain of his under 18 team. Well, that's actually a pretty good level. Oh yeah, but he was dominating junior football because he was he's a lot bigger than the other kids, and everyone will catch up and all that sort of thing. It's almost too obvious.
Yeah, it's much better than some kid who can run around a witch's hat quicker. That's what frustrates me.
But they can improve them quite considerably, because, you know, once they get into our program, we'll improve.
Oh yeah, and we've seen some fantastic programs.
We're going to back
our clubs at the bottom of the list.
We're going to back our system in. We're going to back our program in.
Yeah, because we've got a few clubs who are just excellent at bringing in a host of draftees and making that rapid rise up the ladder as they wallow at the bottom.
I'm sensing you being facetious, Jim.
I'm sensing very much
facetiousness
so.
This morning from you in your comfortable state. Bobby's in Seaford. Good morning, Bobby.
Morning, guys. How are we going?
Going well.
Got a question for you. When does a goal umpire in his final say when it's behind? In the same game you're talking about now, I think it's the first or second quarter, Hawthorn and Geelong, the ball clearly went through for a behind, and because the umpire didn't acknowledge David Roden, who was the goal umpire, and in the replay you can actually see him say it was a behind, the umpire said play on.
Yeah, I actually do remember that. And the boundary umpire actually signalled it was a behind, so, you know, he puts his arm up.
Then the field umpire said play on.
I think the boundary umpire, no signal was behind, but, yeah, the general field umpire said play on, but they've got to be stronger. The boundary umpire's got to blow his bloody whistle.
Dude, it's over the line.
Keep blowing it, and Dave Roden's got to get out there.
Can I get involved in this discussion?
Well, you can.
That was a disgrace.
So I actually didn't say, I was at the game watching, and I didn't see it.
This was a disgrace.
Horty-torty.
Because we get the television umpire involved with the big screen on and spend forensically over, you know, whether it was over the line or whether it was not, and we stop play and blah, blah, blah. What was the umpire up in the grandstands or whatever he is, the reviewer, what was he doing? Because that was clearly over the line. He has direct communication with the field umpires. He had to get into the ear of the umpires and say, hang on, bring it back. That's clearly over the line.
There's no provision for the umpire to do that.
Well, there has to be.
The third umpire. The bunker man.
How wouldn't there be that if it goes, if every score is reviewed when it goes
every
back
from... Every
goal
is reviewed.
Well...
Every goal is reviewed. On-field umpires call things, send them to the video bunker man, as Jimmy calls it. The bunker man doesn't get involved first and say, hey, Mr. Goldspink. That was over the line. That never happened.
So sometimes we spend so much time worrying whether it's gone over the line or not, but when something is obvious and everybody sees it, there's no provisions to be able to stop the game and say, let's go back.
Well, I'm with Jim. Mr. D-Rod, who's getting a big campaign to get him to the grand final, and the boundary umpire, got to be stronger. So hang on a second, that was over the line.
Boundary umpire's got a whistle.
I agree with that. I agree with that too. But they're wired up. They've got things in their ears, and
well, I think they have
probably given them an electric shock from the grandstand. Just say, hey, bring it back.
I don't think they have the jurisdiction to interrupt play.
Well, they've got to change that.
Well, you want more rules?
Well, it was a very close result.
What if they get it wrong?
If that had determined the result, there would have been all sorts of a circus.
Yeah, well, if Tom Hawkins had to kick that goal, was it 5 points? It was a goal, I think, of the difference, and Tom Hawkins had that shot.
7-8 points, I think it was.
7-8 points. Yeah. And that point had it been paid,
yeah,
it would obviously be different.
Yeah.
So it would have come up, no doubt.
Is that a fair thing to say?
I don't know if we want Bunker Man getting involved in general play.
Hasn't got a good track
but
record.
But it was a score. Well,
but Bunker Man didn't know that.
Well, Bunker Man might have known that, but just didn't Bound have the provision goal to be able to zap the umpire out on the field.
They needed to be stronger. Oh. I think that's an on-field issue as opposed to Bunker Man issue. Because at this stage, they don't have... And I don't think we want to give that sort of authority to Bunker Man either. I just think we'll butcher it and we'll get upset in other regions.
But the umpire...
Let's just deal with it on-field. Because it should have been dealt with on-field.
Just blow the whistle.
Blow the bloody whistle, says Jim. We spent a bit of time talking about the English T20 Blast in the last 4 weeks or so. We know Aaron Finch is going gangbusters from an Aussie perspective, but Callum Ferguson's finding some good form too. Made 102 not out against Notts about 10 days ago. We want to track down that young man and find out how he's going. Callum, good morning.
Thanks for having me, guys.
No worries, buddy. Great to have you on board. Now, T20 is a tough game. It's a brutal game. You've got to be on from ball one out there as soon as you get out there. 102 not out against Notts. Were you seeing him good from the start, or were you just had to work into it a bit?
No, actually, yeah, I found the middle of the bat reasonably early in the innings, which was good. Not necessarily boundaries. We had Moeen Ali and I both had to run far too many in the first couple of overs. started to hit him a bit further as we went, and it was a great day for us. We sort of, funnily enough, Moeen spoke to us before the start of the day, and we looked at it. It was a really dry wicket. We thought, geez, if we can set ourselves for 150, 160, then we'll be right in the game. And because we got such a great start, Moeen and I batted together for about 11 overs. We got well ahead of where we thought we were going to get to, and we ended up with about 200. So fair to say the Payne's Trust were a fair way off the mark with the pass call.
I must admit, when I saw the scorecard about 10 days ago when you made the runs, and I saw him at the top of the order, Moeen Ali, I thought it must have been somebody else. We know he's made some handy middle order and lower order runs for England through his time at Test match and one day level, but opening the batting, is that a new thing for him?
He's done it a fair bit at county level for Worcester. He bats at three in the 4 day side, and then bats at the top in the short form stuff. And I think that's probably how he made his way into the England setup in the first place. Batting at the top, making big runs for Worcester, and then. Obviously finding his way into the side, predominantly probably for his bowling, like you mentioned, but certainly his batting is dangerous, so he's a really handy player for us.
Callum, you've played a lot of Big Bash and 2020 cricket around the world. What's the difference over there playing 2020 in England?
Look, I've really enjoyed it here. One thing that we haven't done in white ball cricket in 50-over cricket is play home and away, and over here getting to play home and away, whether it's 20-over cricket or 50-over cricket, it's fantastic atmosphere and whatnot. And obviously with the crowds in T20 being gangbusters pretty much everywhere around the world, it's no different here. I've really enjoyed, the wickets. I think, over here they've been quite conducive to big scores a lot of the time. But then you get a bit of a mix. You get some of those low, slow, grubby wickets as well. I've really enjoyed it. I think they play a really aggressive brand of T20 over here, where it's pretty much go from ball one. What you do see is sides batting quite deep. You see that in the Big Bash a bit, but we've probably seen, a few more all-rounders in the side. Like our side in particular, we've got our four-day opening batsman batting at nine for us and bowling some dibbly-dobbly off-cutters and leg-cutters. So, you don't generally see someone of that calibre with the stick batting so low. And Nottinghamshire were a bit the same over the last couple of games as well. So one thing I would say is that it's probably just guys going a lot harder through the middle of the innings than what you'd potentially see back home. But I'd say that the average scores are probably a little bit higher as well.
Yeah, further to that, what's life like as a cricketer over there? Are you playing every second day? Are you travelling a lot? Is there more training? Like, what does like a general week look like for a cricketer over there?
It's hectic. It's a lot more hectic than our schedule over here. I'm not playing the four-day stuff at the moment, but certainly the schedule for the guys that are playing both or all three formats is nuts. They just go from ball one of the season to the end. Quite often they'll play a one-day game and then start, a four-day game the very next day. Not all the time, but every now and then that'll happen. That wouldn't happen back home. You wouldn't ever play a back-to-back T20 in the Big Bash. Well, we played 3 and 4 days over the last weekend, which was nuts. I mean, it really tests a lot of the bodies around the competition, mine included. It's certainly just the work rate that they have to go throughout the season is another level on what we've got back home. Therefore, they have to manage their players a bit. They have to rest guys at different stages and make sure they've got good depth in the bowling stocks in particular. It's quite common for them to play a four-day game, have one day off, and then go straight into another four-day. It's a workload that, really is another level on what we've got back home.
So, Callum, explain to our listeners how many games you play in the T20, because obviously in Australia coming up in the Big Bash season, it's going to 14 games, which is something that we've never seen before. How many is it in the competition in England?
Yeah, it's 14. So, you play almost everyone twice in your league. So they split the competition into north and south groups. Whereas the county four-day stuff is, it's Div 1, which is 8 teams, and the rest are in Div 2. So it's 14 games. I haven't played every game, so it's hard to really gauge whether that feels like it's too much or not enough. But the guys here seem to be pretty comfortable with 14 games, which gives me a bit of confidence that we'll be right back home. But certainly it's a good workload when you put it up against with all the other cricket that they play throughout the summer. But 14 games, all of the home games we've had have been absolutely heaving. They've been hanging from the rafters at Worcester. So, they can't get enough of it over here, which is interesting considering they almost saw a dip in crowds about 4 or 5 years ago when they went, they went north of 14 games and they just flooded the market and people started to lose a bit of interest. So I think they feel like they've got it about right here with 14.
Time for us to touch base with Russell Milton, our EPL correspondent. He's back for another season. He's ready to roll. Russ, g'day.
G'day, Alf. G'day, boys. How are you?
We are very well, thank you, sir. First weekend of matches. Is it as hyped up and as good as it was supposed to be?
Week one, no real major shocks really. All the big teams won. I'm including Arsenal and that. They lost obviously, but against Man City. But yeah, there was no real major shocks. Liverpool comfortably beat West Ham. As I said, Man City won at Arsenal, which was to be expected. And I was at that game, which was the first one for Unai Emery after Arsene Wenger. Tottenham won at Newcastle, didn't they? 2-1, which you boys will be happy about. Chelsea comfortably beat Huddersfield, which we, sort of touched on last week about Huddersfield and how they're going to struggle. And United kicked off the weekend with a 2-1 win against Leicester City to dispel a little bit of negativity that was going around there beforehand. So, it was, a weekend of not major shocks, really.
Russell, I just need to check. Did you say Arsenal lost?
Oh, that's not fair.
No, I'm just checking.
Yeah, thanks for that. Yeah.
Oh, no, okay.
Yeah,
so we just...
I was down, actually, yeah. And, Man City, really, you would have to say, are in second gear. They look quality. And, and they still left people like De Bruyne and Leroy Sané on the bench and brought them on at 2-0. Arsenal players and fans must have thinking, oh, my God, this could be 4 or 5. But it was interesting to see, I wanted to see how Arsenal were going to change under Emery. And it was... different, certainly different to Wenger. They were playing out from the back, although Wenger's teams did play good football. It was bordering on suicidal at times, especially with Peter Cech in goal. I mean, he's a fantastic goalie, but we were talking about keepers last week and the fact they've got to be good with their feet. Now he's had to change, 36 years old, change a lifetime of how he plays. And you know, trying to play out from the back, and Man City were pressing and winning the ball high, and, you know, it was a little bit scary at times. It could have been more. Arsenal had a good spell in the second half, but then City went down the other end and scored and made it 2-0, so fully deserved for them, and it just shows that Emery's going to take three or four chances of windows before I think he can really change the culture of the club.
Well, we've resumed normal transmission. Obviously, Arsenal losing, Man City being dominant, but Chelsea 3-0. I know they beat Huddersfield, who are going to have their struggles, but is there a serious challenger this year to Man City? Can Chelsea, can Liverpool, can they all put it together, or, you know, another surprise and seriously challenge?
I think Liverpool will be the ones. They look very good. I mean, quite big things are expected of West Ham this year. They spent very well and very big. But, you know, Liverpool were pretty impressive, really. Salah was back on the score sheet again, wasn't he? And I think Pellegrini, the West Ham manager, he likes his players to play a high line. Now, when you're playing against Liverpool, it's very dangerous because they're very quick. But, you know, they make so many forward runs. And Firmino, Salah and Mane got in time and time again. And really, this could have been 10. It was an absolute, you know, masterclass from Liverpool. And I think what Jurgen Klopp's done, he's sorted stuff out of the back. You know, the Alisson, the keeper, looks different class. He should do it, 70-odd million. Van Dijk at the back, centre-back, looks massive colossus there. You know, he looks very good. And then in midfield, they've got Keita, who's come in and done very well, alongside James Milner, who played very well as well. So, you know, and he's still got people like Jordan Henderson to come in. So they look a real good team. Now, it's just whether Liverpool can produce that high-intensity football every week, and week in, week out. You know, do they get injuries to serious injuries to major players? But I think they could be the ones that could really spoil City's season, if anyone. Chelsea won't be too far behind. The only thing is, will they get used to the new manager and quickly? And I mean, they started very well, obviously, with a 3-0 win at Huddersfield. I mean, they bought very well as well, especially with Jorginho, the midfield player. That's a very good player. You know, they had a comfortable, like I said, 3-0 win against Huddersfield. So, particularly those two, I think. I think Tottenham will probably be in the top four, but, you know, that again, we said last week, didn't we, they don't, you know, they if they have any major injuries, I think they might struggle, but at the minute, they look good too.
So, Russ, just on that, and, you know, we've seen, as you said, Manchester City start so well, and the expectation is they're going to be right up there. One of the talking points has been that a lot of the other clubs around the mark haven't really got aggressive in the transfer window. Will that change at all based on what happens in the first couple of weeks, or do you forecast that not much will happen until possibly that sort of mid-season opportunity?
Well, yeah, I mean, the next one is January. I mean, the crazy thing over here is that the Premier League finished the transfer window closed last week.
Right, okay.
But in Europe, it's still open
at
the end of August. So what we've done, really, we've stitched ourselves up a little bit because we can't go and buy anyone else, or English clubs can't go and buy anyone else from abroad, but European players can come and nick our players.
So that's a new change, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, really, it should all be in line. I mean, it was the end of August, you know, so it was 2 or 3 weeks into the season. But now we've seen fits, for some unknown reason, to change it. And, you know, maybe we think we're above it all and the Premier League doesn't need Europe and all that lot. And, you know, but it's a very dangerous game because someone like Real Madrid could come in for, say, Eden Hazard or someone like that and say, right, it's 200 million. Do you want it? And then Chelsea, if they did say, well, all right, we'll need that, we'll sell him, they can't then go and get someone else because our window's closed. We can't get players in, which is a crazy situation. And, I mean, I do think that the transfer window should be done before, if you're going to have transfer windows, they should be done before the start of the season, full stop, across everywhere. But because their season starts a little bit later than ours, and, you know, that's the reason for it, so in Europe. But, it's a crazy one. So, people have to do it. Get their buys and things done, and get their players and get the squads together. So that's it now till January. And, you know, I think Man City only bought one player in, and it seemed it fit to about get one player in, Riyad Mahrez, £60 million. And, you know, they look unbelievable. So it's going to be January before anyone else can really sign anyone and bolster their squad.
Max Gawn, who is the premier ruckman of the competition, bordering on the best player in the competition, and he's a part of our team. We think that's fantastic. Good morning, Max.
Morning, gents. Thanks for having me.
Not a problem. Pretty subdued start there from you, Max. You've been in the dark room for 12 hours again.
Stock standard morning, gents.
How was the wash-up from the weekend? Have you been in that dark room which you spoke about in the play-on?
We haven't been to the club yet. So
no,
we tend to get Mondays off after Sunday games. Keep everyone nice and fresh, and especially after a loss like that, no one really wants to go in anyway. So So today we'll go through our review, and obviously it'll be a fairly honest one, and learn what we did wrong. We still had some good things. I mean, 60 inside 50s to 40 is still, and that seems to be a trend in some of the games we lose.
Yeah.
In about three or four of the games we've lost this year, we've won inside 50s by a serious
good
amount.
Good
That's something we'll look into, but I think my gut feel is the 120 uncontested marks that they took will be the main driver of the review today.
Just going back to that 60 inside 50s or whatever it may be, have you got a thought on why? Is it you're bombing the ball too long? Are you not making the most of the guys coming up with the kicker? Is there a common theme when you do that?
It's probably a bit of a difference in the first and second half. The first half, we made Alirelia look like the best player in the competition, which he probably, in fairness, he's playing some pretty good football. Mm. So we struggled with a little bit of that. And then in the second half, I felt like we actually got the shots on goal. We were just missing them. So I think we still had 27 to 30 shots on goal from the 60, which isn't too bad. But probably a tale of two halves. First half, we kicked it to them. Second half, we kicked it to the points.
They're both bad outcomes, by the way.
Particularly for Melbourne fans, take us into the review today. Not so much the specifics of it, but were you going nervous? Were you going sort of anticipating what's going to be said? What's Simon Goodwin like in a review after a disappointing loss? Does he get angry, or is it all very measured, which is what we see from the outside?
I'm not going in nervous. I want to know how we fix that, so how it doesn't happen again. West Coast play a very similar brand to Sydney. They'll chip it around if they're allowed to, which will mean potentially another 120 uncontested marks if we don't get it right. So, I'm pretty excited to get in there, see some of the stuff that we probably don't want to see. And the best thing about football, especially when you play away that week, is you get a chance to go away as a team. And we've done well this year in times we've gone away. We beat West Coast and West Coast last year when we had to as well. So it's going to be a pretty exciting game.
We've talked a lot this year about Melbourne fans and how they're so excited about what's possible and then so frustrated about some of the results we've seen this year from you. As a player, what was the overriding feeling on Sunday?
It was extremely disappointing, especially throughout sort of the last two or three minutes in the last quarter, when it just felt like we were giving it all and Sydney just kept holding up a wall, and then you realise you probably should have done that earlier in the game. And it was a disappointing feeling post-game. And Melbourne supporters are getting frustrated, which they're allowed to be. It's funny, they're probably more frustrated this year than they have been in the last 10 years. And we've probably played our best football in those 10 years, but it's just frustrating when you can't get the results against some good teams. And that's something that we're trying to work out in-house as well. But the reality is we got the team that's sitting second and the team that's sitting third in the next two games, and we got to win one of them.
Correct, and that's a tough finish to any season for anyone. It doesn't matter where you sit on the table. Just on Sydney building that wall which you spoke about, when that's happening, and they're the best at it, have been able to absorb inside 50s against, and have been for ages. When that's happening and it keeps coming back out and you don't get what you will get the results you're after, can you start to feel tension rising amongst the group? The bloody hell, we're having that many opportunities, but we just cannot bloody kick a goal.
There's a couple of little wall incidents I had. The centre bounce stuff, I was just getting on top of my other ruckman in the last quarter, and they went completely defensive, and they almost read our minds in what we were doing. And we think we got a lot of options in the centre bounce, and they almost counted every single one. And then Isaac Heaney's in it, just as a loose man back in the goal square.
Yeah.
We knew that, but the last couple of minutes and the energy going around, it's bombing inside, and that probably cost us a little bit because Isaac was able to take marks. Even when we tried to hit Jesse Hogan on a lead, Isaac Heaney took mark of the year. So,
and was going to punch.
Yeah. So everything wasn't really working in that last 5 to 10 minutes. And I mean, it's a credit to Sydney. That's why they've been playing finals for the last decade.
Just on a light-hearted note, will you put the poster on Jesse's locker? I know teammates can be very cruel. Will you remind him of that?
Um, Probably not with Jesse. Jesse's one that can probably throw a punch back at you, so I might steer clear of that.
Busy playing Fortnite, isn't he, according to your article on the weekend?
Award-winning column.
Award-winning column.
We did enjoy reading that the other day. But are you aware, as a group, they lose Alex Johnson really early. Nick Smith does his hammy. Are you aware that they're two down? Is it a quarter time and half time? Are the coaching staff going to you, get some speed on the game, let's get some run on the game because they're a couple short?
It is mentioned. I noticed when I came to the bench and so did Cal Sinclair at the same time, and then he came back on 20 seconds later, and I sort of said, geez, that's not much of a rest. And you look across and there's not much going on their bench. And to touch on Alex Johnson, that's a well, obviously, there was about a minute gap in the play waiting for him to get off the ground, and that was a pretty horrible minute. Just thinking about what he's been through. I'm nowhere near him, but I've had 9 knee surgeries, and for him to come back for potentially 6 recos, I'm not sure what he's going to do, but at least he was able to taste AFL again, which is a good news story, but that probably hurts more in a way as well. So that was a pretty bad minute, but yeah, we definitely touched on the fact that especially 2 tall defenders as well, so we were able to put Pedo forward. We thought that might have worked, it didn't, but and in fairness, we probably did have the legs in the last quarter. They just played some pretty good contested footy that kept us out.
What was the atmosphere like when Alex Johnson went down? I was at the ground. The crowd just went dead silent. It was an eerie feeling.
So did the Sydney players where I was. I was sort of being a bit vocal, saying, "Come on, please get up, please get up." Mm. And there was nothing coming back from the Sydney guys. So they were obviously quite distraught at what they were looking at. And as were the ground, and I suppose when you saw him a quarter time and he had a bit of a tear in his eye, you had a feeling that it was probably it. And I, as soon as the siren went, I was trying to look for him, and I managed to find him and go shake his hand, but it was a pretty bad feeling.
Does it take the game a couple of minutes to get back up to speed after a moment like that? Because you're right, I mean, the whole footy world was watching, just crossing their fingers saying, I hope it's not the bloody knee again. Does it take a while for the game to get back up to speed?
That may have been the reason why we're up a quarter time, potentially. Swans may have dropped away for a couple of minutes. To be honest, as soon as the football goes back up, you're back playing. So I didn't necessarily feel it, but I couldn't speak for someone like Nick Newman or someone like that.
Yeah,
I want to go back a few days before the game, and you're in doubt, according to the news reports, and he didn't train and all that sort of thing. Were you close to missing?
It's amazing that Buddy hasn't trained all year and I missed one, and I'm apparently not going to play. But I was the sorest I've been post the Gold Coast game, and I potentially should have walked out on crutches, but I didn't want a bit of big media storm, so I bravely limped out. And
that Nui scenario playing out again at the airport.
But I was limping around the first few days, and they said to take the training off, which I did. And I was always confident I was going to play, but there were some doubts throughout the week, and there were some doubts early on in the game when I was still feeling a little bit sore, but it got better, and today I'm in a much better position than where I was last week.
So what is it?
It was a serious corked calf. I've never had something like it, to be honest. I get lots of corks from playing in the ruck, but I usually can walk out of the MCG. So, but I did some serious hours in terms of recovery and joined Clayton Oliver in the ice bath at 1 a.m. when he decides to go. So I was quietly confident I could get up and play, and I did.
So again, going through the process to let us all understand how it happens. Who makes the final call? Do you have to? What hoops do you have to go through to be able to convince Goody or the phys edders that you're right to go?
I made the final call, and to be honest, if I was potentially playing my 10th game, it wouldn't have been my call, because the captain's run wasn't a glowing assessment of how I was feeling. I was putting on a brave face during the captain's run, and I felt like an extra day's recovery and a nice sleep in and potentially warm it up before the game. And even from Corky experience, I know they tend to get better after you warm up, so I just hoped and prayed that was going to happen, and they did.
So was it Sunday morning you ring up and say, yep, I'm right to go? Was it made earlier than that? When's that final decision?
It was a Saturday afternoon call, because Casey played Saturday Arvo, so yep. I still was 24 hours out. That Sam Wiedemann played at Casey, and he was going to come over and ruck. So I made the call pretty early, and once I made that call, I was playing no matter what.
Has Bernie Vince, speaking of Casey, hurt his shoulder and is out for the rest of the year? Is that what I'm understanding from Bernie?
Yep. I believe it's one of those 6 to 10 week sort of AC surgeries. Went in straight away. It's obviously a pretty sad story. He was playing some relatively good football. Unfortunately, he missed out on selection last week, but was still going to be around the mark to play in the next few weeks. And he went in for surgery that night, so yeah. I almost haven't seen him since, and hopefully he's there today.
Can I ask you about James Harms, the emergence of James Harms? He's becoming a really influential footballer for your team, and perhaps for the first 3 or 4 years of his career, he's sort of been floating around the edges, but this year there's obviously a different role. He's played a bit of a run-with role at times. What's happened? How's he become this player? Who's the mastermind behind getting him into that role?
He's got a relatively good story, Jim. He was number one in the rookie draft and didn't play AFL in his first year and was potentially going to get going straight after his first year because he was a bit of a party boy, and he was just a classic guy from Cranbourne, to be honest.
Wanted to all that Cranbourne list.
Yeah, but he has really developed his game, and this year he's slightly gone to more of a defensive role, especially in the last 4 or 5 weeks, and taken out some of the biggest names of the game, including Selwood and Dangerfield against Geelong and Sloan against Crows. And it's something that it's really good that he can add that to his game. Potentially next year that would mean that he could become a well-rounded player and he wouldn't need to tag, and we can get another midfielder to go along with Clayton Oliver and Angus Brayshaw. But he was doing the job to Josh Kennedy as well, to a point where we had to get rid of the tag to try and win the game. But it's good for James. He's playing some good football. He's never played 22 games in a year, so this could be the one.
We get to find out the latest news in the world of footy. From the Herald Sun, Scotty Gallen is back again. Good morning to you, Scotty.
Morning, Daniel. It's good to be here.
Got the Vegas Golden Knights hat on again. You're really riding that train, aren't you?
Well, you know, first year they make the granny. I'm pretty keen to stay on it.
You forgot to mention as he walked in, well, the corporate
next.
Wear.
Yeah, that was next.
I will say it's a tad old.
That's but a Herald Sun.
Is it school photo day today?
I've got headshot day. Support my employer. Like, you don't, clearly. You're in a rival outfit.
What do you mean?
Aren't we
wearing
other
stations' attire?
No, born in blue. Aren't we a certain manufacturer?
Oh, apparel partner.
Correct.
Yes. While we're the good people at Nike doing great things.
And they're not right now.
This is, in fact, a Nike top.
With 3 stripes on it.
It's just a different version. It's old school.
A different Adidas Nike look.
It's a retro.
Okay.
Is it Adidas or Adidas?
Adidas, with a small A. Don't put a cap A on it. I used to do that all the time. I didn't know it was a small A till about 3 years ago.
It's always a small A.
Okay. Well, I'm with you.
Addie Dazzler.
No, we're all looking good. James has got a woolen outfit. Where does that come from?
Oh, my cupboard. Clearly, you got changed in the dark.
Yeah, mate. I get up at 2 o'clock to get here.
The Polo Fleece Herald Sun top's working a treat.
No, I actually do like it.
It's working a treat.
Bring one in next time for me.
Is the MRO working a treat, Scotty?
Tex Walker, too. I think that's our starting point for discussion. What are your thoughts, you learned people?
James being a man on the panel.
It was a fairly... It ticked all the boxes. Yeah, lift, turn, all those...
Position of power.
Hurt of hurt factor.
He was concussed.
Yeah. I think 2's about right.
He went to hospital that night.
That's it. Maybe 3. Maybe one more for hospital visit.
So
I did see it on replay before. I saw it a few times across the weekend. But even just watching it again on replay before on one of the screens we've got up in here, he did let go. Like,
he did.
Which minimised the possibility.
But it's still part of those dangerous tackles.
No doubt he needed the whack.
Yeah, it's a sling and it's probably not a dumping or driving into the dirt.
Because there were some calls of 6+.
These are the same people calling for year bans for gaff.
Yeah, and red cards and all that sort of stuff. Yeah,
okay.
Those sort of people who are very emotionally invested at the moment and are doubling down on these type of issues. Yeah. It's absolute folly to be suggesting that's a 6-week sanction.
Of course not.
We're trying to get that out of the game, and I think a 2-week sanction for that, considering what happened. And I emphasise the point, he did let go.
And it's still part of the game. You're still allowed to tackle.
Yeah, just got to do it correctly. A bit like bumping.
Yep, exactly right. And it can can fit in that table and can the boxes can be ticked. So,
so what's Nathan Brown going
to
get?
I was just about to ask the same question.
Good question.
See, I'm not. I'm. It was a bump. Yes, he got concussed. It was a bit late. I'm not as in uproar as half the population.
No, but the problem. Sorry, half to jump in. The problem they're finding is because it was so long after the ball left, they're not counting the bump as it normally is. You know, graded as careless. So they've made it intentional. Which
you've
is
had enough time to figure it.
Which is very rare for bumps to be intentional unless the ball is so far away.
Yes.
But one of the big questions is, did he actually get him in the head, or was it the whiplash and him hitting the head on the ground that caused...
Whiplash.
I mean, because he was not expecting contact, it was so much more dramatic than what it otherwise would have been. Because clearly it was late, clearly it was not within the, you know...
boundaries of fairness.
Yeah,
and it was a truck hitting a small car.
Yeah. Well, that's right, it was. But... Yeah. But I mean, but this is the whole thing. I see it as a two-weeker. I don't see it any more than that. But it's gone straight to the tribunal.
It has to be more than three now, doesn't it?
It doesn't have to be. They can if they can successfully argue to downgrade the classifications,
intentional to careless. Yeah.
Yeah, or high to medium, or body to head, or head to body, or whatever it was.
If they can downgrade that, why can't he do this?
He could have. I think he could have. Now, he's clearly erred on the side of caution here, and I don't mind that.
I'm happy with what he's done.
Because we go to the tribunal, you get to defend yourself, you get through the system. Yeah. This is why the system's, I think, working quite well in terms of the tribunal access this year and the fact there's no threat of going and get another week or that type of thing. I quite like the fact it can go to the tribunal. I'm okay with it. Now, I would have graded it differently and got it done in the boxes, but I'm okay with it going to the tribunal.
What boxes are you ticking? Sorry.
Well, I had careless high and high would get in two, and I think that's about right.
Yep. I'm comfortable with that.
Yep.
But it is fascinating, Whitey, because as you say, the point of contact was shoulder to sort of shoulder front of chest region, not head. The whiplash was a result of the contact because he wasn't braced for it. But that's you're actually saying that the impact and the contact is high and it actually wasn't.
Yeah. And
it was to the body. We were captivated by what was happening at the Bellarive Country Club and the USPGA, the 100th edition of that major tournament. Greg Chalmers would have been watching it all unfold with great interest as well. He joins us on the Breakfast Club. Good morning, Greg.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
We're going very well. Thank you, buddy. Where were you watching yesterday's action at Bellarive?
You know, mate, I was firmly planted on my couch with Scotty doing well. Tiger up there again, second major in a row where he's been up and around it. So I thought I'd like to see Scotty win, and then secondly, I'd like to see a Tiger win again. So there was a lot of intriguing stories going on yesterday, and it's been manic the last couple of majors.
Is golf better when Tiger's contending?
Yeah, that's the easiest question in the world. yeah, absolutely. It's just, you saw the crowd yesterday and the energy he brings to it. He's just amazing, and, you know, the British Open, he was leading, tied for the lead, I think, with seven holes to go, and then yesterday was one behind with sort of seven or eight to go. So he just seems to find a way to get back into it. It's quite an amazing comeback and story thus far. So, you know, see how he goes over the next few years and see what he can do.
Greg, did you think that this was in him to be able to not only do what he's doing contending, but even just the distance he's back hitting the golf ball, considering the injuries he's had? Has it surprised you?
I don't know what, I can only go off what everyone's telling me about, you know, all the injuries and everything. I don't know what his body feels like. I thought if he could get to a place where his body feels at 80% okay, then he could compete again. Because he's Tiger Woods and he's just very, very, he's brilliant, is the simple way to put it. And so I've seen him at his absolute best way back in early 2000s. And it's debatable whether or not he's going to play at that level again from tee to green, but I think just the competitive side of him, his will is far greater than other people, it seems, and his ability to get the ball in the hole, regardless of what you saw the front nine yesterday. He didn't hit one fairway and he shot three under. So he's just willing the ball into the hole, and he's quite amazing to be able to do that.
Greg, you did mention you've seen him at his best and the injuries. Like, he's not going to be able to physically, I guess, be as capable because of all the injury toll. But when you were sitting on the couch, was there something he was doing where it just clicked for you going, yep, he can genuinely compete again? Was it you know, his iron play? Was it the way he was rolling the ball on the greens? Was there just something that, you know, ticked it off for you?
It's been those two things you said, the last two things you said over the last little bit. His putter was troublesome there for a while, and he changed flat sticks recently, just before, a couple weeks before the British Open, I believe. And then he changed to a different model. He started rolling the ball pretty nicely, it looks. He's always, I mean, at his peak, he was the best in the world at that. His short game seems to be back where it needs to be. I mean, a few years ago, he couldn't chip from me to you. Let's remember that. And now he's back just getting up and down from everywhere again. The driver and the iron play was brilliant. If you got it in the fairway, you thought he could stuff it in close. So the driver is the only club that seems to be giving him any issues right now. If you look at the difference between him and, say, Brooks and even Adam Scott, who they both drove the ball really nicely. And, you know, Brooks just drove it down a road there and crushed it a long way. So that's the next step. If he gets that sorted out, look out.
Well, speaking of Brooks, have you gone down to your local health food store and bought a heap of protein shakes and doubled down on the gym membership? Is this the way golf is going? The big brute athlete, you know, starting to win and you know, dominate tournaments?
Well, mate, I walked past him in Memphis this year, which is about 2 months ago, and I'm like, who the hell? Like, I've known Brooks for a while, and I'm like, who's this guy? Because he looked like, you know, like what they would call a linebacker, like a second row of football at home or something, you know? Like, he's a big dude. it could be the wave of the future, you know, like there's a lot of kids that Rory went that way a little bit. I don't know if that's what you need to do to lift a, you know, 120-130 gram golf club and swing it really fast. But if you look at what Justin Thomas has built like, and he crushes it as well. So there's a variety of guys who do it for different reasons, whether it's, you know, just looks like the feel of it and looks good, or if it helps your golf, more power to you. A bit late for me, but it's going to be interesting over the next 10 years if we're going to have guys driving at 350 consistently and look like they should be running on a footy field more than picking up a golf club.
I know some guys with some protein powder, Greg. I can sort you out if you like.
Yeah, thanks, mate. Yeah, I'll look forward to peeing in a jar at some point.
So, Greg, we were having this discussion over the last couple of days because of what Brooks did. Is it, you know, carrying the ball 300 metres off the tee, is that good for golf, and is it difficult for others to be able to keep up with that if that's what's going to happen?
Yeah, so it's been quite extraordinary over the last, I'd say, 8 to 10 years, just what we've seen in terms of what used to average in the top, you know, 30 in driving distance. You can see from 1 year to the next, guys will say, well, I'm averaging the same, but I'm now another 10 guys are going past me. And that's what's happening as the younger guys are coming in. Their swing is different. They don't. If you think back to like a Nick Faldo who was 6'4", but swung it, you know, very smooth, you know, sort of not up and out of his shoes like these guys are. And all these guys have what that's called like a jump release, where you almost jump through the ball and your feet are off the ground and you only got toes on the ground at best. Certainly that front foot comes off the ground at some point. There's a lot about that as they generate that torque and power that everyone's going to be doing, it seems, as the young guys coming through. So is it better for the game? It's just different. I mean, it's so difficult. I'm worried about sort of where we're going to be in 10 years' time and 20 years' time is because all our golf courses aren't designed to hit at 350 or 370. They're going to just be obsolete. What are we going to do, just build more bigger golf courses? I mean, do we really want to do that? That part bothers me, but I'm hopeful the governing bodies will get their stuff together here soon.
So specifically on you, we actually wanted to really chat to you about this because, you know, you're one of the great putters in world golf. So that's your advantage. Brooks's advantage is clearly he can putt okay, but clearly is his length and, you know, Rory, Justin Thomas, etc. Do you feel that you can't compete anymore because of that, or do you still feel that the good things that you've got in your game and other players that are seen as really good putters will say, well, you know, you can drive it as far as you like. I'll just get you on the greens. What's your mentality when you go out and play golf now?
Yeah, so for me personally, I have to tell myself that, that I can compete. But in all truthful and honesty, I would say I know that if he shows up with his A game and I show up with mine, and I don't mean just Brooks and John, I mean anybody at that level who crushes it, like Dustin Johnson, Jason Day, pick a name. If they show up with their A game and I show up with my A game, then I can't compete. It's simple. It's just, it's a power game now. I look at liken it to a swimming pool. When I jump in the deep end of my talent, mine might be 30 feet deep, but theirs is 80 feet deep or 100 feet deep. Tiger at his best was certainly beyond that even. So when they've dived to the bottom of their talent pool, they're going to beat you. I have to dive to the bottom every time and hope they play poorly. That's how I look at it. So, yeah, it's challenging.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.